This is Startups for the Rest of Us, Episode 4. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or are just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experience to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week, Mike?
Not a whole lot. Just sitting here in front of a lot of hardware, like we discussed earlier.
Yeah, it seems like you have about two data centers worth of hardware behind you in your basement. What's the story behind that?
Just a lot of stuff that I collected over the past couple of years for some enterprise software that I was testing. What I was doing at the time was I was doing a lot of testing for enterprise applications and systems management. So I had to have tons and tons of machines up and running at the same time so I could demonstrate that you could do something and push out policies and it would apply to different machines and do whatever you told it to do on the right machines. So I had SQL servers and Windows and Linux and Solaris, HPUX, AIX, etc. Tons of stuff.
And judging by the stack of Dell boxes behind you, did they name a wing or a building after you? Is there like the Tabor building?
You know, I'm still working on that. I think they're breaking ground sometime in 2015 or something like that. I don't know. But they're waiting on my check.
Nice. So. Yeah. Well, very good. Anything new this week? Anything interesting?
Not that I can think of.
All right. Well, I have plenty interesting to talk about. So I'll talk for both of us. How about that?
That sounds great.
I spent a lot of time this week doing some .NET Invoice stuff. Once again, I've been spending a lot of time on it. I like doing kind of binge work on a project, so I'll work really hard for 2 to 4 weeks on it, and then I won't say I'll ignore it, but I kind of put it on the back burner and let it run on autopilot. Actually, about the past couple of months has been a lot of .NET Invoice work, and last week I pushed a new landing page live.
Was that the one where you were doing A/B testing on the video?
That's right. That's right. It's an interesting experiment. I'm kind of wondering how it's going to turn out.
I like the video. I thought it went a little fast, yeah. But I think that was probably intentional on your part just to kind of get through things and make sure that you got everything that you wanted to get said.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think that it does come off a little fast.
Yeah. If I were to do it again, I would definitely cut some pieces out. I really like the narration and the copy that I wrote and read. And then once I started recording stuff, I recorded too much. That's the bottom line. So yeah, it's too rushed. The problem is going back and editing at this point, it like breaks all my timing and my changes, so it's a pretty big hassle. I may look at going back and doing it, but it's like once you layer all these things on top of each other, then as soon as I change it and it changes the time, I have to edit the audio, I have to edit the music background, there's just a ton of undoing. So it's something I wished I'd have caught earlier, because once it's published, it's like, oh man, it's not a 5-minute fix at this point.
Yeah. I can imagine that.
Yeah, you know how it is working with video. The interesting thing is that I've never done this before. I'm A/B testing the home page of the website. So it's not just the landing page. It's actually that page with the video. Half the people are seeing that as the home page. And I'm checking out which one gets more people to our demo.
Are you starting to see any results at all?
Yeah, so far this landing page is just getting crushed by our normal homepage. The normal homepage for the listeners is just a standard kind of 37 signals homepage with some screenshots and a try now button. And then this other thing that I may be testing is really going out on a limb, and it's just very stripped down landing page. There's no top navigation. Actually, above the fold, there's no links at all. All you see is a video and some very brief copy and a guarantee and then a box that says try the demo. And all the navigation's in the footer. So it's really focused and basically saying, if you like this video, try the demo. And that's all we're trying to get you to do. And so far, very few people are trying the demo compared to our normal homepage. You know, our homepage gets pretty high conversion rates on that. So it's a trip. So I think it'll be a shorter, I mean, in a good way, I think it'll be a shorter A/B test cycle than a lot of A/B tests you do. You know, because if it's really close, it takes weeks to figure this stuff out. But I mean, when I looked yesterday, it was 9 to 2. Yeah, it was like 4.5 times more, 450% more effective than our normal homepage. Oof. Yeah, it was like embarrassing.
More effective or less effective?
Less. The landing page is less effective.
So the video landing page is less effective.
Okay. And I certainly don't think it's because of the video. I'm actually considering, I mean, the next step after, if this video landing page doesn't work, is to take that video and put it on my homepage and test it against the current homepage, just to see if the video draws more. Anyways, that's what I've been up to. And I mean, certainly in long term, it'll lead to improvements, even if this particular iteration doesn't.
Well, that's interesting. It'll certainly be interesting to find out how well that works out for you. Because, I mean, I think that a lot of people are trying to try other things, and video is obviously one of those things that might or might not work. My biggest concern with video is the fact that your video probably illustrated this quite a bit, is there's just so much stuff that you want to squeeze onto it and want to be able to say. Because a video is very linear, and you and I have talked about this before, even just editing audio for other things, you have to really pay attention to that specific point in time. It's not like a web page where you go to a web page and you have complete and utter control over where you look and how you look at it. And that's great, because if you want to skip to like the second or third paragraph of something, you can. But with a video or audio, you can't. You don't have that option. So you are forced into listening to it or watching it in whatever way somebody else wants you to. And it's very difficult to skip ahead and to know what it is that you're skipping ahead. You can't skim a video, for example.
Yeah, that's a good point. It is. It's interesting. And that's why I think A/B testing of video versus no video is a better test than what I'm running now. Because I think my landing page itself is having a negative impact rather than the video part of it. I think in general, video will outperform other stuff as long as it's a good video, and it can outperform text, but that's not going to happen in every situation.
I read an article recently someplace. I wish I could remember where it was, but it basically said that for the time being, probably for the foreseeable future, if you create a video for something and you try to market that online, especially with Google, what will happen is your video, because there are so few videos out there, Google is tweaking their search engine such that they're mixing video results into their search results, and they're weighting them a lot
Absolutely.
Higher than they will on regular text. Because of that reason, they want it to catch on. They want people to be seeing those things in there. And because video is difficult to search, obviously, I mean, they have to do something.
Absolutely. So. Yeah. No, Google's been doing this for quite some time, maybe 6 months, 9 months. And that's absolutely right. It is, if you put out a video and it gets quite a few views and it gets any type of clout in YouTube, then it will appear on the first page of Google. And it's a lot easier to rank for that kind of stuff than it is for text these days. So, you know, a lot of search engine marketers are going in that direction. You know, another interesting thing is YouTube. I've heard this from two places now. I've heard that YouTube is now the third largest search engine.
Really?
Yeah. That many people use it. You know, you go to YouTube and people type in whatever, recipe or this or that. So it's justification for creating some videos. I mean, that's what I'm going to do. I actually haven't uploaded the video I created to YouTube. It's only in Vidler right now because of the higher quality and higher flexibility. But I'm definitely going to put it in YouTube. And there's some key things you have to do when you do it. You know, you have to make sure to put keywords in the title, and you have to put some links. There's like a description, and you want to, the first three lines display, so you kind of want a URL in there. So there's some key things to do to take advantage of the few thousand views you might get for something like invoicing software. Because I put up a video probably 18 months ago, and all it is like .NET invoice, invoicing software. And it was what we were using as our demo on our site. And yeah, it's gotten like 3,500 views in the past 18 months. I mean, this is boring stuff, right? Who wants to go watch a video of some guy demoing invoicing software? And yet a few thousand people have checked it out. So definitely think there's a lot to be said there for YouTube marketing.
Yeah, depends on what they consider a view.
It's true. Yeah, it autoplays. Yeah. So if someone just stumbles upon it and it appears, you know.
Or they click on it. It's one of those things where if it starts to load, does that count as a view?
Yeah. Yeah, I think if it starts to play, they count it as a view, maybe 5 seconds or something. So
right.
Yeah, it's pretty flimsy. So today's topic is 8 things we wish we knew when we started out. And you and I have sat down and we put together our list of 8 things that we wish we knew when we became entrepreneurs and started companies and launching products. And I think some of these will not come as a surprise to people listening, but will be shocking revelations. So I'll get started with the first one. I wish that I knew that having traffic to a website isn't enough to succeed. And I wish I knew that when I started out, because I was under the impression that you could launch a product or a website, and if you just got enough people to come to that website, that was it. That's all you needed. I mean, you needed a decent product or a compelling website, but it just turned out that that is so far from the truth. You know, it's not even funny. Traffic quality is a huge deal in terms of having actual targeted traffic. And so much time. I mean, to me, it's like a two-part equation. There is traffic, and then there are conversions. And getting people to convert is as difficult or even more difficult than just generating traffic. These days, I almost feel like generating traffic is an easier task. Like once you get something converting, there are all sorts of avenues to get traffic to come to you. You can use AdWords, you can do SEO, you can create videos like we've talked about, you can go on podcasts, you can start a blog. I mean, all of these things are going to funnel traffic, even if it's a few hundred visitors to start with. But I really do think that that's the easy part. It's getting a compelling offer and getting people to buy your product or at least give you, you know, their email or to kind of opt into getting to know you better.
That's definitely something that if we had more than eight things, that would be on my list as well. You're absolutely right. I mean, traffic just is absolutely not enough, and you really need to know a lot more about the traffic that's coming to your website and be able to do something with it. I mean, you can get 10,000, 100,000 visitors to your site, but unless they're doing what it is that you want them there for, it just doesn't matter.
Yeah, I remember the first time my blog was on the front page of Dig, and I got around 50,000 visitors in about 2.5-3 days. And I thought, oh my gosh, my RSS subscriptions are just going to shoot through the roof, you know? And I don't remember what I was at the time, probably 1,500 or 2,000 RSS subscribers. And I think it went up between 100 and 200 subscribers. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, that's just nothing. You know, that's nothing compared to what it should have gone up if I was able to convert those people. And I think that has a lot to do with the traffic quality from Dig, right? They're not typically going to subscribe. They're more of smorgasbord type buffet.
Sheep.
Yeah, you could say that. Oh, here we go. send your flame emails to Mike at my Mike
go
at startupsfortherestofus.com. No, but
yep. And I hate Macs
and Linux. So here and open source and.
Open source.
Yeah, no, but you have a point. I mean, I wouldn't go as far as, well, maybe I would say sheep. The quality isn't there. People aren't really seeking to actually subscribe to something. They're really just looking to surf around in between playing a first-person shooter and...
Yeah, I mean, they're looking for something interesting. I mean, they're trying to kill time. They're not looking to solve a problem. The problem that they're trying to solve is boredom.
Right. Yeah, it's true.
One of the things that I think that I really wish I had known when we started out or when I started out was the amount of administrative overhead that it takes to not only create but to run a business. When I first got started, I actually did things the official government-approved way. I went out, I got an attorney, I got a CPA, and filled out all the paperwork, which there was a lot of. And as time went on, that paperwork got to be more and more. And it's just a huge administrative headache to run a business. And the thing that sucks the most is that there's all these things that people don't even tell you that you have to do. For example, if you have a corporation, you have to file a yearly, I forget exactly what it is. This is basically a yearly form that you file with the state or the federal government that says this corporation is still in existence. And typically in a larger public company, you would have somebody who does that for you because they take minutes and they submit them to the state and say that, yes, we're continuing to do business. But as a small company, you don't have the luxury of having somebody else who keeps on track of all of the state and federal guidelines that you need to follow in order to maintain the business as a recognized business. And if you don't keep on that stuff, you can actually lose your status as a business, and the IRS can come at you and say, well, you're not really running a business because you haven't filed all of this paperwork. So they'll start nailing you for massive taxes, and you won't get any of those tax shelters that a formal business would offer you. In addition, there's all these other things that you need to do, such as keeping bank statements separate. So for all your business expenses have to be separate from your personal expenses. Anything that you're going to write off, you need to document that. If you go out to dinner and you talk to somebody, you have to write down on the receipt exactly what it was that you talked about. You have to keep track of all this stuff in QuickBooks because, let's be honest, an Excel spreadsheet is just not enough. And the government's going to look at that and they're going to say, well, you know what? We don't accept an Excel spreadsheet as an official document for keeping track of all of the things that you supposedly wrote off during the year. Because you can write anything you want in there. And granted, you can sort of do the same thing in QuickBooks if you know what you're doing, but it's a little bit more difficult if you have to keep track of all those receipts and stuff. The amount of time and effort that goes into making sure that you maintain everything in the official approved way is just ridiculous. And it takes so much time that you don't actually spend nearly as much time as you want to on your business itself. So whether you're trying to build a product or marketing or anything that actually contributes to your bottom line, it takes away from that.
I take your comment on the Excel spreadsheet as a personal and deliberate attack on my approach. So Mike knows very well that I'm the polar opposite. I started my business about 8 years ago, and I've written everything in Excel. I'm totally loosey-goosey with it.
But your situation is different. My business started out as an S corporation.
Right.
So I have some different requirements that I have to follow.
Right.
And because I have two S corporations, I have to do it for each of them, and I have to keep them completely separate from all of my personal stuff.
Right.
And that's the difference between us.
Right.
So it's not a personal.
No, I
okay,
know.
It is.
Yeah, I bet it is.
And your Vista 64 machine sucks.
Oh, it rules. So, yeah, I have been a sole proprietor for 8 years, and only in the past couple of months have I even considered getting an attorney, and I now have one, and I'm going to probably move to an LLC in the next few months for some tax advantages and liability protection. But I did get a CPA a few years ago. But yeah, Mike and I have taken a different approach to it. He went with the S-Corp up front. And even then, I use Excel. I don't use QuickBooks. I'm going to have to move to it soon. But even then, I still feel like there's a ton of overhead, especially with taxes and just all the paperwork that I have to file with the city and the DBA thing that has to be done every couple of years. So I agree with you.
Just a quick note, get the QuickBooks. If you're going to go with 2010, get the QuickBooks 2010, the official guide. I got the one for 2008 because that was back when I first bought it, but that's a very good reference manual because QuickBooks is kind of confusing, especially if you're not an accountant. Mm-hmm. And Accounting for Dummies is another good one to help you figure out like the double entry accounting and how all that stuff works.
Right. Good tips. I actually have been looking at Clarity Accounting, I think it's called, and it's an online QuickBooks Online competitor. So I may go with that just because I don't need heavy duty stuff. I really just need some basic double entry, and Clarity is, it's less expensive, but that's not the reason I'm going with it. It's just way more flexible. It appears to be anyways. And the UI is a lot better. It's made by tech people who know accounting. Whereas to me, QuickBooks is just almost like made by accountants. It's just so clunky when I've used it.
Yeah, the one nice thing about QuickBooks is the fact that you can hand it off to virtually any CPA on the planet,
yep,
and they all know how to use
yep
it.
That's the thing. I'm going to ask my CPA before I go with this move. I have a bookmark right now, but I'm going to ask him.
Yeah, I asked my CPA about it, and he said either Peachtree or QuickBooks. And he said about 1 out of 10 of his customers use Peachtree, and 9 out of 10 use QuickBooks.
Yeah, that makes sense. Number 3 on the list of things we wish we knew when we started out is that one big link won't make you successful. This is an ongoing myth that I keep hearing about. I've blogged about it. And even now when I talk to people, I will hear a developer who's going to launch a product and he'll say, man, all I need is that link from TechCrunch. All I need is that link from Joel on Software. All I need is to get mentioned on Seth Godin's blog or mentioned on this podcast. And I hate to break it to you, it doesn't matter. It doesn't work out that way. That will give you a few thousand visitors. But frankly, even before you get those visitors, you really want to work on conversions. But if you get those few thousand visitors, that fire hose of visitors from one of these links, and your site is not already optimized to help get people along in your purchase process, then it's just not going to matter.
Number 4 on the list is you can't do everything yourself. And outsourcing time-consuming tasks is going to be essential to making sure that you're successful. And I'll give you a prime example. And first one I started out with was the amount of administrative overhead that it takes to create and run a business. Well, when I hired my first full-time employee, we started looking into getting health insurance. And when you're applying for health insurance as a small business, because, you know, obviously the business provides health insurance to all the employees, I was one of the employees and I wanted my own health insurance because my wife was leaving her job. And long story short, the problem I ran into was that when you get into a problem like that, it is completely an administrative problem and it contributes absolutely nothing to your bottom line, but it's still got to get done and you want it to get done right. So what I did was I actually handed it off to my employee and said, you know what, the primary reason for us getting this health insurance is for you, because I had it through my wife and we would have gotten a discount for the business if it had gone through the company instead. But we needed at least 2 people on the plan. I was like, you know what, this is important to you, so pick a plan. You know, you're the one who's going to be responsible for finding health insurance for the company, and make sure you pick correctly, because obviously you're going to have to live with the consequences of that, which obviously works out. But at the same time, I mean, that's choosing health insurance is very, very time consuming. And it's worth looking at that at least once a year, you know, when you're up for your renewal, looking around to see what else is out there. But that's something that I essentially outsourced it to my employee, but I certainly could have taken that task. If I were a single employee, I could have gone to an insurance agent and said, hey, please find me something that is going to work for me. And there's lots of other things that you can outsource as well, and they range from things like doing your accounting, doing some of your marketing, copywriting, building a website, building CSS templates for your website, creating images. I'm a developer. I know a little bit about how to use Photoshop, at least enough to get by and build things, but it's certainly not going to be as good as somebody else. And there's also been times where I just did not have enough time in the day. I mean, I outsourced mowing my lawn to a professional agency because I just did not want to do it. And because it was sucking up about an hour and a half, 2 hours of my time every week. And it was just ridiculous. I'm like, I don't have that time to spend. So I hired somebody to do it for me at like $50 an hour and just said, here, go nuts. It wasn't $50 an hour. It was like $50 every time they came, but still.
No, wouldn't it be like $50 a month?
You know, honestly, at the time, I just didn't care because I was making so much money doing other things that the $50 for them to come and cut my lawn, it just didn't matter to me because it was a lot less than I was making.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So, yeah, you know, I think there are two types of outsourcing that I've encountered. One is when you outsource something because someone else has more expertise than you do. And in that case, you may actually pay more than what you've monetized your time at because they'll do it better. Someone like a lawyer, as an example, you know, instead of writing a document, you are going to pay them a couple $100 an hour, but that may be worth it. And then there's the outsourcing of tasks that you could do, but ideally you're going to pay less than your monetized hourly rate. And that's things like you said of mowing your lawn is a personal task, but all the virtual assistant tasks that you and I outsource, audio editing, video editing, frontline email support, web design, on and on.
Legal advice, tax advice.
Yeah.
All that stuff.
Wait a minute. Not for the cheap stuff. Yeah. Was like, that was the first category.
Oh yeah, we're talking about cheap stuff.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, not cheap. So all that to say, yeah, you definitely can't do everything yourself. And I wished I had known that early on because I certainly did way too much stuff. And I learned how to do things I wish I did not know how to do.
One of the things that I found was that, and I got really hung up on this, was the fact that I knew that I could do a better job than anyone else on whatever it was because it was important to me for certain things. So building a web page, for example, making sure that all the CSS was tweaked exactly right. And I knew I wanted it done in a certain way, and I knew that I would do it better than somebody else because I cared so much more. But the problem with that is that you're not really being a manager of your business at that point. What you're doing is you're getting down into the dirty details and doing things that you really just have no business doing. And not because you care more or you don't have the skill set, but because there are more important things for you to be spending your time on. And even if somebody only does it 80% as well as you do, or 75% or 60%, the fact is that it's saving you time. And that's the bottom line. That's what it comes down to, is because time is one of your most precious assets when you're trying to build out your business. And that's why you outsource these things.
The fifth thing we wish we knew when we started out is to think in years rather than months. It's a common mistake to feel like you can build a project in 2 or 3 months, launch it, have a big success, and you know, within 6 months be making a few $1,000 a month. While that may happen, it's very unlikely. It's going to be a lot longer slog than that. Even the developers I've seen who have done it really well and have applied their knowledge and invested time and money and just launched a product that was in a good niche and really nailed a lot of things, typically the development is about 4 to 6 months, and then the launch and the ramp up to a reasonable, you know, amount of revenue is another 3 to 6 months at least. And this is like minimum if you do everything right. So it really does come out to, you know, between 7 to 12 months, just if you're doing everything right, to kind of get a $500 or $1,000 a month going. And if you make any slip ups, or if you're in a market that maybe is a little difficult to penetrate, there's higher SEO competition, it's definitely going to take you into the years. And I think that we're in an unprecedented time here, that being able to start a business on your own is like nothing in history that has ever existed. And in addition, even being able to think in terms of 7 to 12 months or 12 to 18 months as a time frame for getting a business going and being profitable, making some money every month, that is really unprecedented. Like, it's an incredible time that we live in. But with that said, don't get carried away and don't think that we're so unprecedented that it's like, oh, I'm going to get this done in 90 days and I'm going to be making $2,000 a month. It is very unlikely to happen. The outliers like Peldy, who launched Balsamiq and made several hundred thousand dollars in his first year, it's just a 1 in 10,000 chance. And it's just so very unlikely to happen to you.
That's a really important piece, that the people that you see online who are doing that, they are outliers. And that's just what's so misleading about it, because you look at these people who are out there who are successful at it, and you think, oh, I could do that. And you start down that road. And unless you have that plan in place that matches the specific timeline that you're talking about, you know, at least 7 to 12 months or 12 to 18 or 18 to 36 months. I mean, if you've got a timeline in your head that is easier measured in weeks than in months, there's probably a serious flaw in your business plan. I mean, it's not realistic. And it's not to say it's impossible, but it's just not as realistic. So number six on the list is, don't waste time making the optimal decision. Make a decent decision and move on. And this goes back to, in fact, just a couple of minutes ago, you and I were talking about, you'd asked me about whether I was paying $50 an hour or $50 per month for somebody coming in to mow the lawn. And at the time, I mean, I was well aware that the decision that I was making to pay this money was not worth me shopping around. It was for somebody to come in for the summer and do it, and I just needed it taken care of, and it was not worth my time and effort to sit there and either haggle over the price or bring in a bunch of different people and do bids over it. It just wasn't worth the time. It's almost like sitting there and spending a couple of hours trying to figure out, should I buy this hard drive or should I buy that hard drive? And the difference between them is really negligible. And the price difference is, I don't know, say $25. Well, if you spend more than an hour or 2 hours trying to figure this out, it was just not a good use of your time. I mean, you should have just bought the more expensive one and moved on. I mean, because at that point, you've already wasted more than $25. And by buying the more expensive one, now you're out $25 plus the extra time that you spent on it. So make a decision about what to do and just move on. You're not going to do yourself any favors by making an optimal decision 90% of the time.
The next item on our list is number seven, and it's that marketing and sales take as long to learn as software development. The bottom line is that building software products is not the same as launching them. It's not the same as marketing them and selling them to someone. So if someone spent 2 years or 5 years, 10 years learning how to write code and build a product, it doesn't necessarily mean that they know how to actually take that product to market and make it successful. And it will take literally years to learn how to do that. There's a reason that there are MBA programs in marketing. A lot of developers, including myself when I first started, will look at a marketing program and say, oh, that's just a bunch of BS, right? It's, what do you need to know? It's common sense. And to a certain extent, that's true, but there are so many things that you learn as you go through it. And there's so many things you can learn from someone who has more experience than you, from books, blogs, and just interacting with people who are launching products. And then from launching your own, of course. I mean, experience is the number one thing you're going to learn from, just like with software development. I'm sure when you first started out as a developer, if you're like me, you read some books and you wrote a bunch of code, and over the years you got better. And that's how you have to look at it when you're marketing and selling your own product, is that you have to take some resources and absorb them, and then you have to do it on your own and learn as you go along. But you are not going to be an expert. You're not going to be a journeyman marketer the first day you step out of the gate, just like you weren't an expert coder the first day that you started writing Hello World.
That's an important distinction between building a product and launching a product, because most of the people who are listening to this podcast, I'm going to assume, are mostly developers. Not all of them, but most of them. And in order to become an expert at those sorts of things, the general consensus on what it takes to become an expert in a given field is around 10 years of consistently working in that field, or about 10,000 hours or so. And if you ballpark 10,000 hours into working hours, that's realistically about 5 years full-time doing something. Now, because we're developers and we probably went to school for this sort of thing, we get a lot of that extra time built into it, and probably not quite. We don't come out of college with 5 years of experience, let's be honest. But we do come out of it with a certain amount of expertise. And going back to the distinction between building a product and launching a product, we've got that building a product down. We know how to build a product by the time we get out of college and into the real world. And there's probably a great many things that we don't really understand about, such as the target market and what people are really looking for and why you can't do things a certain way. So as you start building products, if you work for a company that actually ships products as opposed to most developers who probably write internal software and internal applications, but the companies that build products, when you get in there and you start building code for those, they have a set of processes and rules in place that are more informal than anything else, but they say you can't do X. And there's a reason you can't do it, and it's because the product doesn't sell well. And you don't understand it first, but over time, you gradually figure it out, and you learn these things as time goes on. The same thing goes with the marketing and being able to launch a product, because launching a product is just so completely different. You have to learn some of these things, and it can take years to become essentially what amounts to being an expert at marketing. And you have to be able to do both. You have to be able to build that product. And then once you're done building the product, you have to become an expert at marketing and selling that product. So the last one on our list of eight things we wish we knew when we started out is, if it's easy in the beginning, that will probably change. And if it's not easy, that's entirely normal. It's very rare that you launch a product or you launch a service and it's immediately very, very successful. A lot of times you'll see these companies that are either angel funded or investor funded, and they come out of the gate and they seem super strong, and you watch them grow and they become phenomenal successes. And it looks like they do it almost overnight. But the difference between them and you is that they had millions of dollars to throw at a problem and you probably don't. So if you're trying to grow organically, it's not going to be easy. Even if you have lots of money, it's not always easy. I mean, there's tons of companies that burn through millions and millions of dollars every day, and they end up fizzling out because either the market was a failure or their product was terrible. Something happened in the market that made them end up going out of business. They ran into legal issues, or the founders fought and the whole company went to heck. But it's not typical for those companies to just come out of the gate and be wildly successful from day one. It takes a lot of hard work, and hard work implies that it's just not easy. If you have a question or comment, please call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it in MP3 or text format to questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Feel free to include your name and URL if you wish. A transcript of this podcast is available on our website at startupsfortherestofus.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider subscribing to us in iTunes by searching for Startups for the Rest of Us, or you can also subscribe via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com. We'll see you next time.